Blog Talk Radio.
You think they really ready for you now? You think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now? You think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now? Thinking, Chris, shrinking, nah, I just don't brag about the deals I've been inking, honorary degrees from Lincoln, I cross borders like Mohicans and do albums in a weekend, I'm hip-hop speaking, never the weakling, I'm the truth, man, so what are y'all speaking, them lies and them liars, I still make flyers, I still ride bands and say MC for hire, I'll spit the fire anywhere, any place. Mama never told you to stay out of grown folks' face, then you got them rappers with that cold broke face, they toured around the world, then they going no place, my KRS one moves at its own pace. On vegetable oil, no gas, no waste. Then you got these intellectuals, really they're sexual, but they wanna remain respectable. Stop fronting.
Do
you think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now? Do you think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now? Thinking me, I say impeccable, running circles around these intellectuals, what a spectacle, they get mad when I say I and God are identical, you better get on your knees and praise them, these conspiracy theory rappers, I blaze them too, ooh, deja vu, you seen this all before me, slaying your crew, I'm known by all the kids, I studied Dr. King, man, and all he did, people don't stop calling Chris for gigs, cause when I'm on the mic, man, I flip they lid, me getting bullshit, I can't even count all the dough this month I did, from coast to coast, we roasting toast, I'm hot, me and the ice can't get close,
do
you think they really ready for you now? That there'll be many of you now. Do you really think they're ready for you now? Do you think they're really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they're ready for you now? Revolutionaries know the game. We take away the pain like Novocaine. Knowledge reigning supreme, you know the name. This the name that don't play all them games. I ain't gonna call no names or take away no fame. But the airwaves is a shame. And the public don't know who to blame. So they blame rappers like we are insane. Like we are to blame for society's pain. Like they don't know for sure what's in our brains. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Same style oppression, socially rearranged. Many of our problems we already overcame, but we stuck in the past, can't see the change. Stuck in the Hyundai, can't see the range. Stuck in the towers, can't see the planes.
Do
you think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now? Do you think they really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now? Do you really think they ready for you now?
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic at all, but he just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique, it was special.
Can you see by the dawn? So proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming. Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight.
You're about to see in here, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4. I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing along. Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven, ring with the harmony, oh, liberty. Let our rejoice and rise high, south and the North Sea. God of our weariness, God of our solitudes, thou who has brought us this far, oh, long way, thou who has found thy might, to the light, keep us forever, oh, in the past we pray.
Everybody, we're going to be dealing with the death of the great Maya Angelou. We're going to be doing this show in her own words, so hope you enjoy. We'll be back in about 4 minutes, Life and Times, and Maya Angelou in her own words. Enjoy.
If you were the last raw egg in the world, then they tighten up, just a little. The first squeeze is nice, a quick hug, soft into your defenselessness. A little more, and the hurt begins. Wrench out a smile that slides around the fear when the air disappears, your mind pops, exploding fiercely, briefly, like the head of a kitchen match, shattered. It is your juice that runs down their legs and staining their shoes, When the earth rights itself again and the taste tries to return to the tongue, your body is slammed shut. Forever. No keys exist. Then the window draws full upon your mind there, just beyond this way of curtains, men walk. Knowing something. Going someplace. But this time, I will just simply stand and watch. Maybe. Maya Angelou was born on April 4, 1928 in St. Louis, Missouri. Still at a young age, her family moved to Stamps, Arkansas, where she experienced a lot of racial discrimination. However, while there, she managed to bond with her family even more and embraced her cultural heritage. As a teenager, Maya had a passion for dance and the arts. She won a scholarship to the California School of Labor, but she dropped out at age 14 to become San Francisco's first ever African-American female cable car conductor. After high school, she gave birth to her first son, Guy. In the mid-50s, she toured Europe for a dance and theater production, and later on, she recorded her own album.
The bongos bongoing, the drums drumming, and the maracas maracking as we get going with Miss Calypso herself, Maya Angelou.
She moved to Cairo, where she served as editor of the English language weekly Arab Observer. Later, she moved to Ghana, where she taught at the University of Ghana School of Music and Drama. While she was in Ghana, she met with Malcolm X, and in 1964, they came back to America so that they could work on the Organization of African American Unity together. But after they arrived back in the States, Malcolm X was assassinated, and the organization fell apart. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. asked Angelou to serve as Northern Coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She has served on two presidential committees, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Arts in 2000, the Lincoln Medal in 2008, received three Grammy Awards, and President Clinton requested that she compose a poem to read at his inauguration in 1993. She received over 50 honorary degrees and is Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University.
What would you, sitting where you are now, say to that young Calypso singer? And that, what would you say to that woman?
I would encourage her to forgive. It's one of the greatest gifts you can give to yourself.
Uh-huh.
Forgive. Forgive everybody. Just forgive it. I mean, mind you, we ask the Creator.
Yes.
To forgive.
Yes.
Our stupidest actions.
Yes.
Cruelest, mean,
yes.
Mean-hearted things.
And say, God, forgive me.
Forgive me.
Or people will say, I'm not perfect. Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
So then you forgive. And it relieves you. You are relieved of carrying that burden.
From taking a lot of interest in social justice and from having experiences in her past, Maya Angelou embraced her womanhood. In fact, her poem, Men, is about her first ever relationship and all the emotions that came with it. In 1936, she was raped by her mother's boyfriend, Mr. Freeman. After she confided about the rape to her brother and testified at the trial, he was found and beaten to death by her uncles. She didn't speak in public for 5 more years as a result of guilt and the belief that her words had caused his murder. This event is the basis for her first autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
You can't forgive without loving.
Yes.
And I don't mean sentimentality, I don't mean mush.
Mm-hmm.
I mean having enough courage to stand out and say, I forgive. Forgive the man who had raped me when I was 7 years old.
Mm.
I had to get there. And that was a matter of incredible mental gymnastics. And then I had to think of what I had done to other people and see how I'd been forgiven.
Although she had a troubled past, one thing is for certain. Maya Angelou's art, presence, and words have impacted the world positively, and they will continue to in the future.
Love me or leave me and let me be lonely. You will. When it looks like the sun was a shining in the moon, God put a rainbow in the sky. That statement was inspired by a statement from Genesis. We're told in Genesis that the rain was persisted so unrelentingly that people thought it would never cease. And in an attempt to put the people at ease, God put a rainbow in the sky. That's Genesis. But in the 19th century, an African-American lyricist, a poet, probably a woman, I'm not sure about that, said God didn't just put the rainbow in the sky. God put a rainbow in the clouds. Since then, we know that suns and moons and stars, comets and novae, all sorts of illumination, are always in the firmament. But clouds can go lower and louder that the viewer cannot see a possibility of light. But if the light, if the rainbow is put in the clouds, that means that the worst of times, the meanest and cruelest of times, the viewer can see a possibility of hope. Because the rainbow is in the clouds themselves. I was keen to come to Memphis, and I'm keen to be here, happy to be here, because of Agape. I know that I'm talking to rainbows in the clouds. That's who you are. In the worst of times, here you are, looking to brighten up somebody's sad morning, hoping to enlighten somebody's lonely evening, praying to put some grits on somebody's face. Yes, I think that this is when we're at our most noble. This is when the nobleness of the human spirit comes out. When we look to see if we can help somebody who may not look like us, whose face may not look like our faces, whose complexions may not jive with our complexion, who may not call God the same name we call God, if they call God at all. But here we are, trying to brighten their dark day, trying to enlighten their lonely, their midnight. Look at it. At our very best, we can't be better than that, I don't think. I mean, I've been thinking a long time. I wanted to speak to you about some of my rainbows and to just remind you of your power and how blessed we are to have you. I know that the idea is to be a volunteer, and to be a volunteer, not to to be misused or abused or overused, but to really be of use. And I grew up in a town in Arkansas about as large as this stage. And my mother and father agreed to disagree when I was three and my brother five. And they sent me and my brother to his and my father's mother in Samson, Arkansas. And it was an amazing gift. For a long time I thought that they had abandoned us. When I really realized it, what they had done is given us to the best person in the world, my grandmother, who was the daughter of a former slave who owned the only black-owned store in the Dallas town. I don't know who she was. I can't imagine this woman. How did, in the 20s, and how did she convince white jobbers that she was reliable and would be able to pay them back? I don't know who she was. I just know that she was a rainbow in my crowd. She said she taught herself to read from the Bible, and she taught herself to figure from the almanac. Imagine it. I stayed with her until I was 7, and then I was taken with my brother to St. Louis, to my mother's people. She had returned to St. Louis to be with her family. I'm sorry to say, at first, my brother Bailey and I tried to become city kids. We learned to eat sliced bread and all sorts of, just exotic things. But I'm sorry, after about a few months, my mother's boyfriend raped me. I told the name of the rapist to my brother, who was my black demon son. Bailey then told the family the name of the man, and the man was put in jail. He was released from jail. He was released after one day. And the police came to my mother's mother's house. Big white policeman with blue serge suits on, huge brass buttons. They looked like giants to me. And they told my mother's mother that the man had been found dead, and it seemed he'd been kicked to death. It was within my hearing. I thought my voice had killed him, so I stopped speaking. I stopped speaking for 6 years. I wouldn't speak. My mother and her family did their best to woo me away from my mutism, but I wouldn't. I knew that my voice had killed people. I would only speak to my brother because I knew he loved me and I loved him so much that I couldn't hurt him. But no one else. So after a few months, my mother's people and my mother sent me back to my grandma in Stamford. And Mama would braid my hair the way old black ladies still braid girls' hair. Girl sits on the floor. Mama sits in there. And the girl holds the mama's side like that. And my hair was huge and very curly. So Mama would put her hand behind my neck like that, so she wouldn't break my neck by accident. And then brushed all this hair. She said, Mom, sister, Mama don't care what you people say about you. You must be a moron. You must be ignorant. You must be an idiot. Mama don't care. Mama knows when you and the good Lord get ready, sister, you're going to be a teacher.
Yeah.
You're going to teach all over this world. I must thank Miss Rose, this brilliant angel and rainbow in the clouds. I thank her for not going on and on about what I've done, what I'm doing, what I hope to do. This is one end. So open that crockpot and stove, throw me in it. I found, of course, he was so tenderhearted. He wouldn't allow us to kill a spider or fly in the store. We had to find the offender, catch him, and take him outside. Where Uncle Willie thought we would kill him now. But Uncle Willie, his role as a rainbow in my life, look at this. After he died, my grandmother died, I went down to him. I stopped in Little Rock. Daisy Bates met me at the airport, one of America's great treasures. She met me, she said, girl, I don't have to tell you that she was black. She said, girl, I know you're down here, you're on your way to town, but I talked to people in your office, you're staying overnight here in Little Rock. There's somebody dying to meet you. I want to bring him to your hotel. So I said, okay. She brought about 40 people to the hotel. She brought this black man who was all of that. Thank you. She said, I know you're down here because Willie has died. Now, my Uncle Willie was so ashamed of being crippled that he wouldn't even leave Sam's to go to Louisville, which was 5 miles from Sam's and the county seat. This man in the drinking suit, looking all of that, said, you know, the state of Arkansas has lost a great man losing Willie. The United States has lost a great man losing Willie. Uncle Willie? He said, I mean the world. I said, let me sit down. He said, I was the child of a blind mother. Your Uncle Willie gave me a job in your store, paid me 10 cents a week, and taught me my time statement. He said, because of him, I'm who I am today. He said, you want to know who that is? I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm mayor of Little Rock, Arkansas. This man, I'm looking all of that, and mayor, one of the first black mayors in the South. He said, because of the power vested in me, I have a group convoy outside of your hotel tomorrow morning to convoy you down to Sam's. He said, I want you to stop in Louisville. There's a good old boy there, and he's a lawyer. He'll look after your property. The next morning, I went down to Sam's. There were 6 white policemen with huge guns, badges to convoy me from Little Rock to Sam's Island. Imagine it. Just think of it. When my brother and I were young in Sam's, the boys that they were called would ride over into the black area, threaten, maim, and kill people, because they didn't agree with God's choice for the colors of the people's skin. Then I would look out the window at these men. They'd come over on horseback and jump around in front of the store. And they'd look, they look like giants with huge guns. All those years later, I went downstairs from the hotel, and there were 6. And crippled and dead, still having the power to be a rainbow in my class. We stopped in Louisville, and I would expect an older black lawyer with a little horns and a bob. I went to the lawyer's office, a young white man came. He said, Mr. Angelo, I'm just laughing to meet you. He said, the mayor called me from Little Rock, told me you were coming down, and I want to be of any help I can for you. Imagine. Look at it. This is who you are. This is exactly who you are. You have no idea who you will become. The people you are volunteering to help, the people you're looking after, the people you're being kind to, they may be who? They could be anybody. It could be Maya Angelou. They could be Coretta Scott King. Just look at it. They could be Martin Luther King. They could be JFK. Look at it. It can be somebody whose face you will never see, whose name you will never know. And yet, this person may change the world, may help us eradicate this line of ignorance, of racism from our country. She may be black, she may be Spanish speaking, Asian, she may be fat, she may be thin, he may be gay, he may be straight. But somebody you're helping can change the world. It's amazing. And so I had to come. I live in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I stopped traveling on planes some years ago. I just don't travel on planes for a number of reasons. But first I become quite well known, and so people see me in airports, and the same people who would be kind and gracious and courteous in the restaurants or maybe in the living rooms, in church, the same people in the airport to lose it. That's my answer, because I look like my answer. And sometimes they grab me, they choke me, they give their babies to me. Sometimes I'm going to ask, would you like to change them first? And the cabin attendant came and knelt beside my chair and said, Dr. Angelou, I can't tell you. You know, my God, you've changed my life in this. And I said, thank you, dear. But maybe you'd like to help your colleague collect the ticket. People put the things up. Oh, she said, I had Brad Pitt on my plane. I didn't do that. And then when we got up into the air, we were about that. At that lamp, when that person came out of the cockpit, it was the captain. And I said to Lydia Tucker, who is my daughter, really, my travel companion, I said that, oh, we're in trouble. But the captain stopped at my chair and said, Dr. Angelou, I saw your name on the manifest, and my daughter is studying you up at Smith. And I said, who's minding the soul? And he said, oh no, and you know, really condescending, oh no, we are automatic pilot. I said, get back in there. This is not the only way to do this. And I called my office, I called around, and by nightfall I had a bus. It was Clint French's bus. State of North Carolina, it's a 10-hour plus drive. It's no small matter. So when I say I'm glad to be here, I mean it. Last call, I got paid. And my first cousin was Greek. And so Angelopoulos, Angelo was once Angelopoulos. And I got to tell you, it's love. And it is probably the most powerful word. Sometimes we use it loosely. But it means I take responsibility for the time I take up and speak and ask it. It means I love you. And that does not mean erotic love necessarily, sexual love. It means I love you. I take myself beside you. I take responsibility for myself as I treat you, stranger and friend. It's a wonderful word. And it is, it levels us all. It is, I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to TV One on Point. I'm Armstrong Williams, your host. Over the last season on TV One's On Point, we have brought to you some incredible people who are on the cutting edge of political, social, and economic thinking and policies in this country. But as we scale the country and travel around the United States and the world, there's a consistent name that people ask for. When are you going to sit down with and you're about to meet this person? And believe it or not, for all the interviews that we've brought to you on TV One's On Point, I must tell you, this one is very special because we're about to introduce to some and reintroduce to others the poet, the author, the singer, the dancer, the scriptwriter. Oh, wow. She is just one of the most celebrated writers and speakers in the United States. She is consistently on the New York Times bestsellers list. And we travel on location for this very special interview to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to the home of none other than legendary individual herself, Dr. Maya Angelou. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
To TV One on Point. When you smile, Dr. Angelou, and I want to get into your family,
yes.
But when you smile and you think about your life, and God has just so richly blessed you,
yes.
But in those blessings, you've had challenges.
Yes.
If you think about your life, what would you say were the most difficult and the most challenging years of your life? Why, and what do you take from that to make you who you are today?
Well, Armstrong, I think every year has been challenging. Every day challenges, truly. Some of the challenges were more public than others. Some so private I couldn't even mention them in public. Some having to do with health. Some having to do with prosperity. Some having to do with romantic love. Some having to do with my family. The same issues which face and beleaguered every human being in the world have and still do, have beleaguered me and still do. So that the challenge for me to meet you this morning, to get up defying gravity and stand erect and to remain erect and to be absolutely present with you so that everything I know I have here in this chair with me now, I don't know what you're going to ask me. So I'm challenged to be as honest as possible, as courageous as possible, and as kind as possible. That's what I'm challenged. I was challenged as a young girl. At 7 years old, I was raped, and I told the name of the rapist to my family, and the man was put in jail for one day and one night and released. And 3 or 4 days later, he was found dead. And the police informed my grandmother that the man was found dead and that it seemed he had been kicked to death. They said that in front of me. That traumatized me so that I stopped speaking. I thought my voice had killed the man. And I thought if I spoke, my voice might go out and just kill anybody randomly. So I stopped speaking for 6 years. So I learned to read. And I read every book I could find. And I memorized. The challenge now, I was growing up in a little village in Arkansas about the size of this room. And the challenge for a black child not to speak was no small matter, because black people believe speak when you're spoken to, especially when I was growing up. But my grandmother was a traditional southern black lady. My grandmother said, "Sister, mama don't care what these people say about you, must be a moron or you must be an idiot because you can't talk. Sister, mama don't care. Mama know when you and the good Lord get ready, you are going to be a teacher." I used to sit and look at that woman and think, can anybody be this stupid? I mean, what is she talking about? I'll never speak. I'm strong. I have 55 doctorates. My last was from Columbia University. I teach all over the world. So the pressure on me, the challenge on me was always mitigated by love. That is to say, it was softened by love. Because my grandmother loved me, my uncle loved me, and my brother loved me, I came through that. I have come through so many challenges because of love. Not romance, not like, not desire, but love. It is the most powerful element on the planet, or in the universe. It may, in fact, be that thing which holds the stars in the firmament, as far as I know, and that thing which keeps the blood rushing in our veins. I mean, that stuff.
What happened? Tell us the moment. I mean, 6 years being a mute.
Yes.
That's almost an eternity to some people. Tell us about the moment when you realized that you would not be this way.
Forever.
Take us back.
Well, I read, there was a black lady in my town, Mrs. Flowers, and she would take me to the school, black school, and there was a library. It was one room. It seemed to me thousands of books. I realize now that I have more books in two of my libraries, my private libraries now, than that. But it seemed so many books. She said, "I want you to read from here to here, maybe from A to E. Read every book." So I read everything. And since I didn't talk, I mean, I had nothing else to do. I read and I memorized. And she continued, Mrs. Flowers continued, and I had a little tablet. My grandmother gave me like a 5-cent tablet. And she took her pocket knife and made a groove in a number 2 pencil and tied a string into that groove and the other end of the string into the spindle of the tablet. So that's how I communicated with anybody. I just, Mrs. Flowers, for 6 years, tolerated me. And then one day she invited me to her home. She would always give me tea cookies and lemonade. She invited me to her home, and she said, "Maya, you do not love poetry." So I wrote, "Yes, ma'am, I do," and I gave it to her. She wouldn't look at it. She said, "You do not love it." And she pointed her finger at me. And you know, among black people, and especially in the South, especially in those times, we don't like that. I mean, we have a phrase, "Don't put your finger in my face." She's right in my face. She said, "You will never, I can't even do it to anybody today." She said, "You will never love it. Not until you speak it, you feel it come across your tongue, through your lips, you will never love poetry." And I ran from her. I ran down to my grandmother's store. She followed me. She harassed me.
How old were you at the time?
About 12.
12 years old.
12
and a half.
12 and a half.
You ran down?
She was taking my friend from me. Poetry was my friend. And so I ran like the dickens. And she came down. She pointed her finger at me in front of my grandmother. Now that's some
that's
nerve.
That's a no-no.
But Mama let her do it. And finally, she harassed me for about 6 months. And finally, I went under the store. The one part of the house of the store was on stilts. And chickens went under there. And it was really soft dirt, like powder. And I went under the store. And I tried a poem. And I realized I had left my voice. My voice had never left me. So I started.
You began to speak?
I began to speak.
Hold that. Hold that. She began to speak. We're in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with Dr. Maya Angelou for TV One's On Point. We're going to take a break and come back. She learned to speak.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that much more when we return. And welcome back to TV One's On Point. I'm Armstrong Williams. We are live to tape in the beautiful state of North Carolina at the home of Dr. Maya Angelou in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It is so good being on location. I mean, you, after 6 years, spoke again.
Yes.
What was the reaction? Who was there?
Oh,
what did you feel?
I went inside, and I said...
You went inside where?
Inside the store.
Inside the store.
Mm-hmm. My grandmother was just used to me not saying a word. I could talk to my brother, Bailey, my brother who was 2 years older than I, and my heart, and really... A part of my early affection for you was because of my brother, because my brother was about your size, your color, as handsome as you. And he loved me. He taught me everything. I could speak to him, and every now and again I would. I knew I loved him so much that my voice wouldn't kill him. When he came here, I was doing an interview, and I said, at least a couple of times a year, I would speak to my brother. And my brother said, yes, but most of the time I didn't understand her. Bad boy. But I spoke to him, and I spoke to him in front of my grandmother, which was nothing. I mean, I just didn't do that. And my grandmother hugged me, and it was took some time to come out and trust that my voice would not harm anybody, that it was really all right.
What was it like for you, a young girl, with all the scars that you had endured as a child, all of a sudden you wake up, I think I read this somewhere, you had sex for the first time.
First time.
For the first
time.
And the only time, and you got pregnant.
Yeah.
Here you are, about to be a single mother in 1945.
That's right.
What was that like?
It was terrifying. Save that love again. And I don't mean indulgence. There's a world of difference. Sometimes parents think that they're showing love to their children when they indulge them. That's not love. That's indulgence. That's another matter. If you love somebody, you want him healthy. You want her strong. You want her hale. You want her full, ready for life. My mother loved me. So she never put me down. I had to finish school, though, but I had my brother. So I told Bailey when I was about 2 months. He said, don't tell Mom or she'll take you out of school.
About the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He said, because, and it'll be almost impossible once you have the baby to finish high school. And at that time, it would have been. So he said, just don't tell her. And he was in the Merchant Marine. He said, we'll hold hands across the sea. Which he did, we did. When I told her, she simply asked, do you love him? I said, no, and he doesn't love you. She said, there's no point in ruining three lives. We're going to have a wonderful baby.
You know, I find it interesting. You know, in our conversation, you've talked about your grandmother, but now you're introducing your mother.
Yes.
Was she always involved in your life?
No. She had, for all intents and purposes, abandoned us from the time I was 3 and Bailey was 5. We went back to her when I was 7, and it was her boyfriend who raped me. So I went back to Arkansas to my grandmother, my father's mother. And went back to her when I was 13 plus. And she scared me. She was so worried. She knew so much, and she moved so fast, and she talked so quickly. And I didn't feel that she was really my mother, so I called her Lady, and that became her name until I was about 22. And then I called her Mother.
What made you call her Mother?
Well, because I began to realize some parents, oh, excellent parents of small children. They dress them up in the cutie little things and their little bow ties and their little bows and things, and they just love them to pieces. But when the child gets to be 13 or 14, they don't know what to do with them. I heard. They say, shut up, sit down, go over there, you know, go to Europe somewhere. My mother was a terrible mother of small children. But she was first rate, super duper. Of a growing adult. She talked to me like I had some sense, and she liked me. And when I was about 20, she said to me, you know, baby, I think you're the greatest woman I've ever met. I was 20 years old. I had a son almost four. I've lived in two rental rooms and had two jobs. My mother had a 14-room house, owned a hotel. I wouldn't take a penny from her, not even a ride.
Did you know your father?
Yeah, I didn't like him much.
You don't want to talk about it. No, Ricky, keep going.
I had an uncle who was all right.
Uncle. Well, just brief. Why didn't you like your father?
He was not a nice man.
He wasn't a nice man. Okay, go ahead.
But my uncle was everything.
His brother?
Yes.
His brother?
Yes. His brother.
Your childhood is fascinating. Do you feel your childhood, there's such a debate today about two parents' household and family values. Do you think your life would have been any richer had you grown up with a mother and a father? Mm-hmm. Do you think you missed anything?
Not a thing. The best thing that happened to me was they sent me to my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Mama in Arkansas, my father's mother, taught me the values I have today. But let me finish telling you about Vivian Baxter, my mom.
Your mom.
She said, you know, you're very kind, and you're exceedingly intelligent, and those two virtues rarely go together. She said, you are one of the greatest women. I was 20 I've ever met. And she said, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, and my mother. She said, yes, you belong in that category.
Wow. She had that kind of insight.
My land. She went across the street. She went into her car. I went down the street and waited for the number 22 streetcar. And I got on the streetcar. Armstrong Williams, it is as fresh to me today, 50 years later, as it was then. I remember getting on the streetcar, the wooden slats on the back of the streetcar, the light, the sunlight that came in through the windows. And I sat there, I thought, suppose she's right.
Ooh.
Suppose I really am somebody. She's very intelligent, and she says she's too mean to lie. So suppose I'm going to be so. I thought maybe I better stop cursing and stop drinking. I mean, I didn't curse much, and I didn't drink much, but I thought maybe I'm going to turn into somebody.
You found something good in yourself. Hold that for a minute. Hold that. This is good. This is TV One's On Point. Our guest today, oh, she is in rare form. I mean, the rarest of form. Dr. Maya Angelou. We're in our home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and we'll be back. Back to TV One's On Point. I'm Armstrong Williams, and we're still with the legendary writer, author, mother, grandmother, wife, more than once, Dr. Maya Angelou. And welcome back. Thank you so much for doing this and allowing us in your home.
Thank you very
much. We're so honored and humbled by it. But back to your experiences as we were discussing before we were going out to break.
Well, some people are great parents of young adults. After they can make sense of them. And other people are It's rare to have a person who's a great parent of the growing child right up to adulthood. Very rare. That's why teenagers have such rebellion against the number of their parents, because their parents have been so indulgent while they were little, and now they think, I want to do this and I want to do that, and the parents can't comprehend. So if you really shift a gear and say, I'm talking to a young adult who may not know much but wants everything, knows how much everything costs but values nothing, you see? You have to know that and take some patience with the person. In my mom's case, she had exquisite patience. At 17, I told her my son was 2 months old, and she had this big house and live-in help him. And I said, I'm leaving. She said, you're leaving my house? I said, yes. I found a room with cooking privileges down the hall. She said, you're leaving, and you're taking the baby. I said, yes. She said, oh, I said, I found a job. She said, all right. Okay, you leave this house. But realize, when you walk over my door sill, you've already been raised. Don't let anybody raise you. That means you know the difference between right and wrong from what you've learned from your grandmother, your Uncle Willie, and me. You know the difference between right and wrong. Do right. She said, whatever relationship you get into, you will have to make compromises, adaptations. That's all right. Don't let anybody raise you. And remember this, you can always come home.
Why were you leaving?
Oh, because I couldn't. I was a woman. I had a baby. No.
It was not your mother's responsibility.
No, indeed not.
Wow.
It wasn't my mother's responsibility, nor was it the state's responsibility.
I want to go back to something, which I think is so crucial in this interview. The self-esteem that you got from your mom when you least expected it, when you really saw, well, maybe I am something special. I can be somebody. I could be among those great women like Eleanor Roosevelt. How did that change you and your career path?
Well, as I said, it did tell me to stop smoking. I just started playing with smoking. Stop drinking and stop cursing. I didn't realize a whole lot of people were great who smoked, drank, and cursed. But my grandmother had always told me, she said, you're going to be a teacher. So I had no problems of self-esteem because my grandmother and Bailey,
your brother.
My brother.
Yes.
Oh, Armstrong Williams, if you had known my brother was the genius. If my family ever made a genius, we came closest in making Bailey Johnson. Bailey would tell me, remember, I was about 13. He said, all knowledge is spendable currency depending upon the market. Learn everything.
Mm.
He was 15 years old, a black boy from a little village in Arkansas. He told me, he said, you're very intelligent. You're the smartest person in the world, almost. You're not as smart as I am. He said that you're a woman and you're supposed to let me open a door for you. I'm supposed to hold a chair for you.
Your brother.
My brother. So that kept me. I was 6 foot tall. He was 5 foot four and a half.
I want you to think about it. I want to come back to something you talked about, the conversation about right and wrong.
Yes.
And the conversation about it was not your mother's responsibility.
Yes.
After you had that baby. Bill Cosby was in the news much of this year, talking about personal responsibility and accountability. And you talk a lot about a black girl, a black boy. You place emphasis on this word black. And I'm sure there's something deep in terms of your descriptions, and I want to get into that. But how does what Bill Cosby is saying today play into your own upbringing? And what responsibility it is for the so-called black community to resolve many of the issues and crises that we face today? Yeah.
Well, I was by the media. What did I think of what Bill Cosby said? And I said, I rarely answer a question with a question.
Mm-hmm.
but in this case I must. And my answer is, did he lie? Did he? No, he didn't lie. He may have been, maybe he could have been more tactful, but he didn't lie. We have always been a responsible people. Always, from slavery on. And in the last 20 years, we've lost a sense of self. And we've lost an ability to teach our children a sense of self. You did it. You paid for it. That's it. We used to have a phrase into the 60s, every tub sits on its own bottom. Mm.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yes, sir, rebound.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden we want everybody else's to sit on somebody else's bottom. What is that? How can you hold yourself? How can you say, I want to do this? I want to make a change. I want my life to mean something. I don't want to just live and die up on this earth and live nothing but despair and revulsion. No. This is my one chance to be me. My one chance. You see?
No, I feel it. And this is TV One's On Point. I'm Armstrong Williams. We're live to tape. And the beautiful homo, Dr. Maya Angelou, poet, author, writer, screenwriter, actress, dancer, publisher. She has a new book out. We're going to talk about her books. I mean, she has been on the New York Times bestsellers list. She's sold books all over the world. And we're just so happy and pleased to have her as our very special guest, TV One's On Point, and we'll be back. And you're so proud.
I'm so grateful. I am so grateful.
What is the impact of your having a child, or raising a child, has had on your life? How has that changed you?
It has encouraged me. I have educated myself largely because of my son. I mean, I read books well after he was born. He wanted to know about babies. He wanted to know about this. And how could I teach somebody and know nothing? So I was a visitor at the library, and every time I could buy a secondhand book, I'd buy it. So now I have, 10,000 books, and my son has 5,000 books, because the books represent the gathered information of human beings all over the world since we've been able to write. So, he meant everything. He tenderized me. And he was asking on national television, he was asking, how did it feel to grow up in the shadow of Maya Angelou? He said, her shadow? I was in her light. He said, I always wish there was a shadow, because she put that light right on me, and I said, please remove that sometime. But he said, I grew up in her light.
Dr. Angelou, you know, people, I know so many wonderful stories about you. I really prepare myself for this interview. I know this story, a very dear friend of yours and a follower to me, Bob Brown. When his wife was sick with cancer and she eventually passed away, you would come off the road the long hours. You would go in your kitchen and cook food and send it over. And you do that for so many people who are going through very difficult times. And, you know, people would never believe that. But, I mean, it just shows you what your mother said, is that you just had such a good heart and such a good person. How you give back, not what people see in the public, but in some of the most intimate and most private moments of your life.
Well, I told you, my mother told me, try to make everything you say two-time talk. That is, say it in a closet and be ready to say it on the city hall steps and give anybody 20 minutes to draw a crowd. That should be true with what you do. I know it can't always be true, but you should be able to do the thing in your private place and then have the light of the world shine on you and still do it, so that you don't have to worry about how can I lie about this. It's not easy, and I blow it all the time, but I do try. What I do in private, I do anonymously. There are public statements that have to be made in public, but I don't need anybody to tell me that's a good thing. I'm trying to be a Christian, Armstrong. Mm-hmm. Now, of all the things I've said, this is the most important. I am trying to be a Christian. Trying to be a Christian is like trying to be a Jew or Muslim or Buddhist or Taoist or Zoroastrian. It's not something you achieve and then you sit back and, whew, I got it. I'm always amazed when people walk up to me and say, I'm a Christian. I think, already? Goodness gracious. I split 70 wide open. I'm working at it. So what I'm trying to do in everything I do is be a representative of my God. I am made by God. I am God's child. And I'm trying to show that I respect it and am appreciative.
Mm. You know, I want to come to this. To me, this is an important aspect of the interview, not to minimize anything else, is that I said in my introduction of you, of how you've transcended race, I look at some of the incredible relationships that you have, from people from foreign countries to people of all walks of life. You've hinted your own experiences with racism, mm-hmm. and the fact that you're a woman who happened to be black was just like a double whammy against you, and how you were able to overcome. How does one, from your experience, overcome isms of race, the isms of prejudice, and still find a way to plant their feet on solid ground, to find success, to find their voice, and to make a contribution to society? Because it seems as though even though you experienced race, you were not consumed by it. Mm-hmm. It did not stop you. How does one navigate those waters?
Well, first, if you don't transcend it, you give victory to the racist. The racist would like to see everybody separated in tiny little tunnels. And so if I say, oh, well, you know, I don't like all, I mean, no whites, they can't do anything. And Asians, no, really, I'm with it. I didn't lose anything in Mexico and in South America. That is so stupid. There are some very bad white people. There are some very good white people. There's some very bad black people, and there's some very good black people. Some excellently good Hispanics, and some terrible Hispanics. Some great Asians, and some horrible Asians. So how am I to look? Who am I, God? I didn't make them. As soon as I am encouraged by anyone or any conglomerate, that is nation or any race, to narrow my life down because of someone else's prejudice, because at someone else's whim, I stop and wonder, who made that rule? To who will benefit? Will I benefit? Will I be better? Really? Will I be bigger? Suppose this is the last chance I have on this earth. You can't tell. I mean, nobody knows. And I'm going to spend that last time. I don't think so. No, sir. I will accept God's people, whoever they are, as long as they accept me, and as long as I don't see them and them critically harming anybody else. I'm against that. I'm against anybody hurting anybody. Seriously.
Dr. Maya Angelou.
Yes.
So eloquent. So well said.
Huh?
This is On Point, TV One special. With whom? Who else? But the voice, the provocateur.
Oh, no. Not a provocateur. I resist that. A provocateur usually says words to make somebody else fall, or make them to show somebody else up, to uncover a lie or something, or maybe to lie. No, I may be many things. I'd like to be inspirational. I'd like to be a friend. I want to be a shero. People live in direct relation to the heroes and sheroes they have, not an idol. An idol encourages people to be more like the idol. The shero encourages people to be more of themselves. That's the difference.
And I knew exactly when I used that term that your spirit would direct you to elevate the conversation.
Thank you.
It was not meant for us, but for those watching. We'll be back. This is TV1's On Point. It just gets better because we have a genius of our time among us, Dr. Maya Angelou. Don't go away. We're coming back strong. I'm Armstrong Williams. Our guest is Dr. Maya Angelou. How in the world did you learn to speak so many languages? And how many languages did you speak? Because you're self-taught. You're self-educated.
But everybody's self-educated.
You have an ear for languages.
I do.
You
but
do.
Then more than that, I have an eye and soul for the human being. Languages are just devices human beings use to tell other human beings how they feel. That's all they are. There's no mystique. A person says, I'm hungry. I'm cold. Where can I find a parking space? Where are the restrooms? I need a job. Those are the same things people say in Peking, Beijing, and in Peking, Ohio. In Dallas, Texas, Paris, Texas, and Paris, France. Birmingham, Alabama, Birmingham, England. Same thing. So when I meet somebody who speaks a different language, I say, how did you say that? And would you tell me? Show me. And so I try it. And I'm just a human being, and the other person is just a human being. So what? So I make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes.
You know, you have a chair at Winston-Salem.
Mm.
You also had an event recently that empowered your center for the health concerns of women, especially African-American women.
No, minorities, men and men.
Men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the health concerns and why it's so important that you feel you need to use your credibility and your good name to bring attention to this.
Well, nationally, there's a big gap between the medical attention given to the larger portion of our society, the whites, than those given to the blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans. We are besieged with high blood pressure, which leads to strokes and, of course, death, heart attack, heart disease, diabetes, and, of course, HIV. You know, we have sickle cell anemia clinics. But we don't have anything that just addresses the minority health. So we're hoping that this institute in Winston-Salem will become a kind of seminal institute, lending itself as a model to other schools and other medical colleges around the country. And already there are two or three that are interested in our model. And so it's going to be a good thing. I'm very grateful to and honored that they've named it for me.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of your books, but your latest book. You know, I was here earlier in the year when they were here to shoot your cookbook, and you were laying everything out, and then when you finally see this thing, and it has come together, and it's complete, you say, oh, my God, there it is. Here are some of the pictures she showed me. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. What is it like being an author? I mean, you're a consistent bestseller.
Well, it's hard work and it's delicious. I mean, it's wonderful. It's exciting to have the success for a number of reasons. It brings me some money. That's one, and that's
nothing
real.
Wrong with that.
That's real.
That's real.
And I deserve it.
Yes, you do.
Nothing too good for the working class,
yep.
Says I.
Says I.
So I like as well the fact that things I think, my thoughts, my dreams, my ideas are in people's hands. I never, ever wanted to write a dust-catching masterpiece. I want my books in people's hands, in their minds, talking about them. I want my ideas in their conversation. They can use my ideas or use them to build better ideas. You see, but at least I will have, they have come to me, and I have given them away. And that's the best thing I can do as a child of God.
You know, people still talk about, I know why the caged bird sings.
Yeah.
A movie was made.
Yeah.
It's taught in classrooms. I mean, you can rarely talk, you can rarely talk to anybody over in the world and mention Dr. Angelo, and the first thing out of their mouth, I know why the caged bird sings.
Well,
why is that bird still singing, though?
Well, because the bird sings, that's a poem written by Paul Laurence Dunbar in 1892. The poem is called Sympathy. And I'd like to say this poem to you.
Oh, yes.
For you and for your viewers. I know what the caged bird feels on me when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind blows soft through the springing grass, and the river floats like a sheet of glass. When the first bird sings, and the first bud opes, and the faint perfume from its chalice steals, I know what the caged bird feels. I know why the caged bird beats its wing till its blood is red on the cruel bars, for it must fly back to its perch and cling, when it fain would be on the bough a swing. And the blood still throbs in the old, old scars. It pulses again with a keener sting. I know why it beats its wing. And I know why the caged bird sings. Amen. When its wings are bruised and its bosom sore, it beats its bars and would be free. It's not a carol of joy or glee, but a prayer that it sends from its heart's deep core, but a plea that upward to heaven it flings. I know.
So far. You know, in our closing moments, I remember you lost your mother, you lost your grandmother, you lost many people that are close to you. You know, I sense from you, I sense your love of God, your love for striving to be a good Christian.
That's true.
And it's every day is a work. 24 hours a day.
I know, and blowing it 85 times at least a day, and saying my prayers at night and saying, Lord, I hope tomorrow to make it 84.
Wow. That's good. So when you think about those that you've lost, do you ever think about dying?
Death, of
yes.
course. You can't reach my age and not think about death. Alas, it intrudes itself. I mean, I get out of the shower and stand in front of the mirror. That which used to stand out like this.
Yes.
So I see my body respond and submit to time.
Mm.
What will not submit is my spirit. My spirit will not. And so in time, no matter what I do, something will take me away from here, and I know that. But what I will do, and I pray to do, is give my spirit back to God as clean as I can.
Thank you, Dr. Angel. Thank you so much. We thank you so much for this quality time.
Thank
we thank you for sharing your voice and your vision and your work with the world, and it's just a pleasure being in your home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Thank you.
On behalf of all of us on TV One's On Point, and on behalf of the production crew that put this together, and Jay Feldman and Aideen King, we want to thank you so much for joining us for this special edition. You asked for her. You got more than what you asked for, I must tell you. And I'm just honored to have been the servant to come here and your part of this interview. I'm just so honored to be in her presence. God bless you. We wish you well, and good day from TV One.
Does it bother you that a lot of young black people today have no idea what that was like?
Somebody dropped the ball. You see, a generation of people thought, I'm going to send my kids to Bryn Mawr and Brown and to James and to Mason, and I'll send them to Princeton and Smith. Mount Holyoke. I'll send them to Yale and Harvard. And everything will be all right. And so I don't have to tell them about how awful it was in the 30s and 40s and even 50s. They don't have to know that. Wrong. It is very clear. He, she, who does not learn from his, her history, is doomed to repeat it. And repeated and repeated ad nauseum.
Is that what we're doing now?
Absolutely. Ad nauseum.
We are beginning to repeat the same.
So it is. This is why this project. Why I said yes when I understood what you wanted to do. Absolutely yes. Yes, I'm a very good fountain of information, and I have no. I have no modesty at all. None. It's a learned affectation. Very dangerous. Modesty is put on from without. Very dangerous. Because life will slam a modest person against the wall, and the modesty will drop off faster than a G-string will drop off a stripper. Humility is the thing one wants. Humility comes from within out, not out on. So humility says, someone was here before me, and I am here. I have something to do. I too have my responsibilities, and there'll be someone coming behind me who I must prepare the way for.
So how do we change? How do we break
the
pattern?
This is absolutely, in every way possible. Don't stop talking. Don't stop putting your hands on the children. I do that. I put my hands on the children, the black children, the white children, I put my hands. So to such a degree that Elmo from Sesame Street was interviewed on the Today Show, and Matt Lauer asked, who you've interviewed or you've talked to kings and queens and princesses? Presidents, who do you like most? And he said, Dr. Maya Angela.
And that's where our hope is.
Here in Washington, D.C., there's a school, the Maya Angelou School. And we accept children who've been in trouble. Only those who've come through the correctional system can go to the Maya Angelou School. And when the young woman, there had been a contest how to name the school, I'd been a supporter of the school. and I was there, as was Senator Domenici and, other senators, and Donna Shalala and Dr. Haidt and Secretary Herman and lots of cabinet folks. And this young woman got up. And she said, well, I won, and they told me I have to read this letter, my winning letter. And I'm paraphrasing her, because she then, at that time, had that same lazy tongue. So she said, well, I think school ought to be named Dr. Maya Angelou. And why? Because Dr. Angelou's been down here. Every time she comes in, she tried to pull us up. And... she's been down low. She's been low as we are, And she's now up there. I mean, she's up there. She's up over all you white folks here. But Dr. Hyde said, what? But they always pull the children, all of them. Don't let one slide. Not one. Not one Asian, one Spanish speaking, one white, one Jewish one. Pull them.
But don't many of those young people who went to Mount Holyoke and went to Smith and Yale, et cetera, don't a number of them say, look, I don't need any.
Well, that's all right.
I don't need to be pulled.
Too bad. Well, if they don't, don't. But I mean those who didn't, because they feel they didn't, they then don't give it to their children. But then they didn't get it. Their parents are the ones who sent them off to the white schools with the idea that this would make them even, well, and normal, and well, and white. Well, it's not. Going to school will not make you white. I have 53 doctorates, which means I've been to 53 universities. Hasn't had any effect at all on my complexion. So, no, it's not.
So these parents, I know some of these parents, the ones that you're talking about, they feel that they're protecting their children from the horrors of the past, that the children don't need to know about what it was like before the Civil Rights Movement. They feel they don't need to know what the Civil Rights Movement was like.
Well, too bad. That's ignorant. It's just ignorance. I'm sorry, but it's ignorant. One can have enormous education and be blitheringly ignorant. Now, that is blitheringly ignorant. He who does not learn from his history is doomed to repeat it. Machiavelli wrote that slim volume, The Prince. And I usually keep in any house of mine 6, 8, 10 copies of it to give to young men and women to read. Because it became the manifesto for all Western nations. About 1507, about. In it, among other instructions, he showed how, if you really want to control the people, separate them, you can rule them. Divide them, you can conquer them. Because I think that I am dour and solemn. Not at all. I mean, just the opposite. I never trust people who don't laugh, who act as if they put airplane glue on the back of their hands and stuck them to their foreheads. What? No, 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 no. Mm-mm. They didn't come to make a difference. If you've come to make a difference, you laugh as often as possible. Because the telephone will ring and inform you of some information that will make you weep. The doorbell will ring and you'll hear something. You turn on the television and say, my God. Pick up the newspaper. Whew. Walk in the street and your car has been stolen. This. No. So as often as possible you laugh. Don't force it, but the Bible says a cheerful spirit is good medicine. And we are just now finding in medical research that that is true. It may be why black people have lived so long and have fewer wrinkles and so forth. And just now, a medical research institute is named for me. And it's just now being established as a part of Bowman Gray Medical School. And it's the Maya Angelou Medical Research Institute on Minority Health. So we will study sickle cell anemia, high blood pressure, diabetes, and HIV, AIDS, of course. And what is this? What is the mystery behind laughter? What is it? that it allows the factories in the body, the various glands, to create more endorphins, which go around the body. I think of them as little visiting physicians knocking at the door. You okay in there? Would you like to have a couple of aspirin? looking after things. Fine. Yes, it's true. So I'd like to see lots of research in that. I also don't trust people who don't love themselves. No, it's very dangerous. People say, I love you, or I hate myself, but I love you. No, you cannot love a person if you don't love yourself. You can want her or want him, want to possess something. But to love, love liberates. And the African saying is, be careful when a naked person offers you a shirt. Thank you very much.
When I was young, I used to watch behind the curtains as men walked up and down the street. Wino men, old men, young men as sharp as mustard, see them. Men are always going somewhere. They knew I was there, 15 years old and starving for them. Under my window, they would pause, their shoulders high like the breasts of a young girl, jacket tails flapping over those behinds. Men. One day, they hold you in the palms of their hands, gentle, as if you were the last raw egg in the world. Then they tighten up, just a little. The first squeeze is nice, a quick hug, soft into your defenselessness. A little more, and the hurt begins. Wrench out a smile that slides around the fear when the air disappears, your mind pops, exploding fiercely, briefly, like the head of a kitchen match, shattered. It is your juice that runs down their legs and staining their shoes. When the earth rights itself again and the taste tries to return to the tongue, your body is slammed shut. Forever. No keys exist. Then the window draws full upon your mind there. Just beyond the sway of curtains, men walk. Knowing something. Going someplace. But this time, I will just simply stand and watch. Maybe. Maya Angelou was born on April 4, 1928, in St. Louis, Missouri. Still at a young age, her family moved to Stamps, Arkansas, where she experienced a lot of racial discrimination. However, while there, she managed to bond with her family even more and embraced her cultural heritage. As a teenager, Maya had a passion for dance and the arts. She won a scholarship to the California School of Labor, but she dropped out at age 14 to become San Francisco's first ever African-American female cable car conductor. After high school, she gave birth to her first son, Guy. In the mid-50s, she toured Europe for a dance and theater production, and later on, she recorded her own album.
The bongos bongoing, the drums drumming, and the maracas maracking as we get going with Miss Calypso herself, Maya Angelou.
She moved to Cairo, where she served as editor of the English language weekly Arab Observer. Later, she moved to Ghana, where she taught at the University of Ghana School of Music and Drama. While she was in Ghana, she met with Malcolm X, and in 1964, they came back to America so that they could work on the Organization of African American Unity together. But after they arrived back in the States, Malcolm X was assassinated, and the organization fell apart. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. asked Angelou to serve as Northern Coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She has served on two presidential committees, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Arts in 2000, the Lincoln Medal in 2008, received three Grammy Awards, and President Clinton requested that she compose a poem to read at his inauguration in 1993. She received over 50 honorary degrees and is Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University.
It was for a benefit, and the people, we wanted Dr. Angelou to be there because I was about to perform, and I think my mother came up with the idea. I was like, no way we can get in touch with Dr. Angelou, and we did. And ironically, that day, to make it short and brief, I got to go to a home in Harlem, and we sat down and we talked, and she started, you know, just I guess she was checking me out to see if she was going to roll with me, you know, like checking
making
out.
Sure he was legit.
Yeah, making sure I was good. And one of the most divine things where I knew I was in the right place and God had sent me, I went to the barbershop before I went to see Dr. Angelo. I had to look good going to see her.
Yes, sir.
I left out of that barbershop. 2 minutes later, some people came and shot up the barbershop.
Oh, you kidding?
I'm at Dr. Angelo's house meeting with her.
Wow.
And that's where I was supposed to meet. God put me there, so that's how I met Dr. Angelo.
Wow.
I had heard of Common, and I had heard some of his music, his art. And I'm an admirer. And I thought, if I could talk to this young man and find out, is that really who he is? And it was my delight to be asked to do so. And we liked each other a lot. And courage is the most important of all the virtues. Because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently.
Sure.
You can be anything erratically. Kind, true, fair, generous, blah, blah. But what I've seen in Common is that he has courage all the time. He has enough courage to stand in front of young people and do his hip hop. He has enough courage to stand on the silver screen and do it. Enough courage to show that he's an African American man with some grace. He's not ashamed to be gracious. It takes courage.
Yes. How important is this? I mean, obviously the work that you're doing through the foundation itself is important. How important also is it to bridge the generational gap, you know, because especially in hip-hop for so long, we've had this issue where, you know, the older folks don't get it, you know, what we're doing. And now as we have gotten older, you know what I'm saying, we're grown-ups, we're parents, we're all that stuff now, you know. How important is that to have that dialogue between our generations?
The one beautiful thing and the incredible thing is, you know, Dr. Maya Angelou, she transcends age and time periods, you know, like, it's a spirit, her spirit will be here forever, like, what she has contributed to this world, it will last in the universe for good, so, you know, even if she wasn't sitting here with me and, you know, with the hip-hop crowd, still, my daughter is studying her in school.
Certainly.
You know, so
certainly.
It's still like, she's already present amongst that generation and all generations, but you know, being able to connect like this is—it also shows the bond, it shows the relationship, and it shows that it is truly like a unity and a connection, you know, and there's no separation. Like was she, what did they call you, the godfather, the godmother,
godmother of American hip hop.
All right, let's go. You got the new hot stuff for us?
No, it's fabulous because it has been my blessing to have had some impact on Richard Pryor,
sure,
Tupac Shakur, Dave Chappelle.
Speak on it.
It's been my blessing to have some impact on Chris Rock, and thank God, with Common. The truth is, we make a mistake when we think that generations can be separated.
Thank you.
The truth is, you need me so that I have shoulders you can stand on.
Thank you.
And you need me so that you have shoulders somebody else can stand on. We are one. And to separate us and decide that we'll be polarized is ridiculous, it's stupid, and it's dangerous. I am responsible to that 5-year-old, that 15-year-old, that 30-year-old, that 55. I'm responsible to you. And I try to live my life as a responsible teacher, giver. Yes, I try to live my life that way. So that I will encourage Common to live his life that way. And this is what he's doing with Common Ground Foundation. He's living his life so that younger people can stand on his shoulders. That's about right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Hold 1 second, please. The vendor is here.
Chicago Defender here. Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, dear. Chicago Defender here. Yeah, I must say this, and I'd like to say it for recording. I grew up in a little village in Arkansas, smaller than this hotel. And my grandmother didn't take the weekly newspaper in the village because she said it was written by white people for white people. But we did take the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier, two African-American newspapers. I'm talking about in the 30s, when the Chicago Defender had the Bud Billiken newspaper and the parade. I couldn't imagine there were that many black people in the world. But we received the Chicago Defender, and I learned all my facts, and even some of my truth from the Chicago Defender. And I later wrote a screenplay, and a character in my screenplay was told, the information was in the New York Times and Time Magazine, didn't you read it? And my character said, if it wasn't in Ebony, in Jet, in the Chicago Defender, it didn't happen. So I love that newspaper. I have been raised on it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The great Dr. Maya Angelou, Common Sense, Chi-Town. I'll be back in one moment.
Away. It's just a shadow wave. I'm Tavis. From Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley on the all-new Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Tavis Talks. Today's conversation should be fun because my guest is my dear friend Paul Mooney, who will be appearing this Saturday, the 20th, on his Black Man in the White House tour in Chicago, my favorite American city, at the Harold Washington Cultural Center. Two shows, one at 7 and one at 9 p.m. if you're in the greater Chicagoland area. Also, of course, appearing around the country this summer. He has touched your life, Paul Mooney has, and made it brighter in many ways, whether you know it or not, by writing for Richard Pryor and for Sanford and Son and, good Lord, so many other things on television. A big heart and a funny guy who joins us now from somewhere on the road. Where are you, Paul Mooney?
They think that because I think that I am dour and solemn, not at all. I mean, just the opposite. I never trust people who don't laugh, who act as if they put airplane glue on the back of their hands and stuck them to their foreheads. What? No, 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 no. They didn't come to make a difference. If you've come to make a difference, you laugh as often as possible. Because the telephone will ring and inform you of some information that will make you weep. The doorbell will ring, and you'll hear something. You turn on the television and say, my God. Pick up the newspaper. Whew. Walk in the street, and your car has been stolen. No. So as often as possible, you laugh. Don't force it, but the Bible says a cheerful spirit is good medicine. And we are just now finding in medical research that that is true. It may be why Black people have lived so long and have fewer wrinkles and so forth. Really. And just now, a medical research institute is named for me. And it's just now being established as a part of Bowman Gray Medical School. And it's the Maya Angelou Medical Research Institute on Minority Health. So we will study sickle cell anemia, high blood pressure, diabetes, and HIV, AIDS, of course. And what is this? What is the mystery behind laughter? What is it that it allows the factories in the body, the various glands, to create more endorphins which go around the body? I think of them as little visiting physicians knocking at the door. You okay in there? Would you like to have a couple of aspirin? looking after things. Fine. Yes, it's true. So I'd like to see lots of research in that. I also don't trust people who don't love themselves. No, it's very dangerous. People say, I love you, or I hate myself, but I love you. No, you cannot love a person if you don't love yourself. You can want her or want him, want to possess something. But to love, love liberates. And the African saying is, be careful when a naked person offers you a shirt. Thank you very much.
Four 7839825. You're Ebony. You there?
You want to ask about papers in Chicago?
You there, Ebony?
Yes, it works.
Okay, we was going live with Ebony. Take it off fast. Off the line. Yeah, that was Maya Angelou. I was trying to get Ebony on there to see if she had any great Maya Angelou quotes. One of my favorite Maya Angelou quote, she had said, if someone shows you who they really are and spend all their time convincing you that that's not who they really are, then they have showed you who they really are. Great Maya Angelou passed away today, and like she said, she left a legacy of a great legacy. She mentioned the Richard Pryor of the world, the Martin Luther Kings of the world, the Malcolm X's, the Dave Chappelle's, the Common Sense, the Chris Rock's. Well, it's great to have somebody who's touched so many lives. You know, she had opportunity to see, she called what, Bill Clinton, the first black president. I'm glad she got a chance to live to see Barack Obama being the real first black president. Okay, this is Jimmy Underground Radio Network. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to try to have a show tomorrow. I know I've been playing my new Music Thursday shows off, but I've been running around here campaigning. I'm going to try to get my little man, Jimmy 1 and Jimmy 2, to take over it, but they've been kind of busy. So I'm going to try to get a show up. Just stay tuned, post up, and follow from there. Like I say every time around this time, good night, and may your God be with you.
All the time I was bound in jail,
hey.
Had no money for to go down there.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on,
yeah.
Hold on. Peace.